from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We knew kids watched too much TV. Now they're spending hours on iPads and smartphones. Little kids, toddlers. They've got their own apps, Sing with Olive, Martha Speaks, their own Fisher-Price carrying cases. They're learning to swipe a touch screen before they're learning how to flip the pages of a book. Maybe it's great. Maybe it's wiring their very young brains in a way we hardly understand. This hour on Point, what happens when toddlers take to iPads? You can join the conversation. Are your young children on a touch screen daily, hourly, every 5 minutes? What's it doing for them, to them? Let's hear just a little bit of one. You can't touch screen it through the radio, but here's Martha Speaks. It's a PBS Kids app that a U.S. Department of Education-funded study administered by PBS found helped children learn new vocabulary. An app.
Hi, I'm Martha. Yep, I'm a talking dog. Let's have some fun at my dog party. Can you find the plate with vehicles on it? That's it. Vehicles are cars, buses, and any other machine we use for traveling. Here comes the dog chow. Ready, set, lick. Keep licking. Yummy.
Touch it, swipe it, interact with it. You've got an app. Show me a book that chirps like that. Martha Speaks. Joining us now from Chicago is Jim Steyer, CEO and founder of Common Sense Media, an organization that studies the effects of media on children. They also provide reviews of children's books, movies, TV, and video games and apps. He's author of a new book out this month, Talking Back to Facebook, The Common Sense Guide to Raising Kids in the Digital Age. Jim Steyer, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Great to be here.
And with me in the studio is Dr. Michael Rich, a pediatrician with a focus on media and health. Calls himself the Mediatrician. He's director of the Center on Media and Public Health at Children's Hospital Boston and associate professor at Harvard Medical Center and Harvard's School of Public Health. Michael Rich, welcome. Great to have you here.
Thanks. Hello.
Jim Steyer, first to you, just how popular are apps for little kids?
Well, they're really popular, Tom. It's quite an amazing change over just the past few years, if you think about it. But today, the research we did on kids 0 to 8 last fall at Common Sense, we found that 52% of kids ages 5 to 8 have used an iPad, and in the 2 to 4 age range, it's nearly 40% of all kids have used an iPad. So this is the new reality that parents and educators and, of course, kids themselves are dealing with. And it's fascinating in both a positive way, but also in, you know, potentially negative way, too. So it's a really major new development in terms of media, kids, and technology.
And it's come on so fast and so young. I was blown away by a YouTube video. You can see it at our website, onpointradio.org, that shows a one-year-old.
Right.
A one-year-old. And parents have clearly brought this child up on touch screens, smartphones, iPad, you name it. This child picks up magazines, and Michael Rich is trying to interact with a paper magazine or book in the way that you would with a touchscreen, trying to swipe the pages, doesn't get turning pages, trying to use fingers like you would to, you know, expand or crunch things down, mystified, looks at a magazine or book as though, what is this clunky thing? It doesn't work.
Right. It's very interesting because you will see often parents putting their kids with an iPad and saying, look how brilliant he or she is because he can work an iPad. And what they don't see is the fact that you put virtually any child of this age in front of an iPad and they'll be able to work it. And what it speaks to is not the brilliance of the child, but the brilliance of the designers at Apple.
These are just kind of naturally magnetic to children. They get the touch and manipulate factor really quickly.
They do. And you know, they're bright screens. They have things going on with them both visually and audibly, and they attract kids just the way a television attracts kids, but they have the added advantage of being able to respond to their actions, their finger pointing, their swiping, etc. And of course, a kid who has only experienced screens but has not experienced the magazine will try to do what works on the screen to the magazine.
Here's another little bit of one. This is called Sing with Olive. It's an app to introduce preschool kids to new vocabulary.
Hi, I'm Olive. Are you ready to rhyme? Come on, let's go!
Into the pop-up world of rhymes. Fun adventures for me and you. Into the pop-up world of rhymes. With Olive and the Rhyme Rescue Crew.
A pop-up world of rhymes. Jim Steyer in Chicago. How on earth is a book supposed to compete with that in the hands of a child?
Well, that's a great question, Tom. I think it's really tough for the reasons that Michael and you just mentioned. There's no question that these new devices are incredibly enchanting, even for the youngest of kids. And it actually adds a new layer of parenting that has to go on now, because as you can hear from the apps, there really is some quality stuff. You know, the PBS Kids Martha Speaks stuff is excellent. There are some really good things that can be done, but it can also be very entrancing and enchanting. And a lot of pediatricians out there, probably Dr. Rich included, you know, suggest you really need to limit screen time, that this is not necessarily the best way for kids to spend too much of their time, and in fact, that there can be some downsides. So it's a fascinating new world. It didn't even exist 3 years ago, but it's part of parenting 2.0 in this digital age.
A lot of parents look at this, as you say, Michael Rich, as not handing off a pacifier, though parents are always looking one time or another for pacifiers, but like a brain enhancer. It must be great for my kid. It's a computer. You know, they must be having some exchange of intelligence here. We can hear how entrancing it is for a kid. I mean, we know the colors are there. Things are moving. It's you touch it, you manipulate it, and it's so like just bright, like any old dazzling toy. But what do we know about – let's start with – education, never mind how the brain is wired and what this means, but for a toddler, is the toddler going to be learning vocabulary, speech patterns, social interaction from an iPad like it would with, I don't know, a mom or a book or both?
Well, the short answer is we don't know yet. This is such new technology, as Jim brought up. I mean, the iPad was only introduced a little over 2 years ago, so that the pace of research is such that while we can understand how many kids have used them or do use them, we don't yet understand the effects of them because these things take time. We don't have a way of comparing a kid who worked with an iPad to a kid who worked with only books until years later when their brain has done that development that's at work. What we have to be careful about with this is not to confuse the fact that the child is attracted to and interacting with the device to say that that's their learning, and that they are not necessarily learning just because they're paying attention to it, because they will pay attention not only to something on a screen that is a fire burning or something scary.
Anything
but they will,
sparkly.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Anything that grabs their attention because of the orienting response, which is a primitive reflex that we all have. Mm-hmm. But to not pretend or not to believe that that is attention or that is them learning, and also not to believe that mimicry is learning, because mimicry is something we can do long before we actually learn something. So what we need to do is really take a step back and first of all understand what developmental stage these kids are at, what they are learning, what they need to learn, and it's not necessarily to build a fund of knowledge. What the most important job of learning in toddlerhood and preschool time is learning how to learn, learning how to get information and to put it together.
We'll talk about that and much more. Jim Steyer, I mean, we have seen how for very young children, these young ages you're talking about, really literally toddlers, they have almost preternatural inclination to interact with these devices. I mean, just you watch parents hand one an iPhone with some kind of app, and before you know it, they're playing Angry Birds, and they're having a great old time. But clearly, a lot of these apps are being composed and sold as learning. What are the learning claims that are being made for apps with that design, Jim?
You raise a great point, Tom, and you're right. I live in the Bay Area, and you know these are, I would call these sometimes the iPad or even a touchscreen phone, the shut up toy, because you know parents are in the carpool, they got their little kid in the backseat, they just hand them the iPad or the iPhone or
some
other
first, and they're off.
And they'd be quiet here, you know, here, use this. It's an amazing way to keep kids, and because kids are engaged in it, as Michael was just saying. Here, you know, we don't know. Michael's absolutely right about both the brain development issues, but also some of the learning potential. We're just beginning to see it because it's such a new phenomenon. I'll tell you, though, common sense is now we just launched a new educational rating system as a result of the new tablets and iPads, et cetera, that are circulating everywhere. So we're now starting to rate actually apps for their educational content because no one's ever done this before. As you mentioned at the top of the show, we rate, you know, movies, TV, video games, et cetera, appropriateness. But we just started we spent a year building a new educational rating system because so many of the manufacturers of these products claim they're educational. Now, we don't know yet, as Michael said. And some of them may, in fact, be good if used moderately and appropriately. But many of the claims are phony, just like the baby Einstein stuff was a few years ago. And, you know, parents are always subjected to a lot of advertising saying your kid needs to be computer literate or they can learn starting at 2 to read.
Mm-hmm.
So there's going to be a lot of marketing and advertising in these apps, and that's literally why Common Sense started an educational rating system.
But Dr. Rich, even if they have educational content, I'm hearing your point is we don't know if kids are really learning that material from this app, iPad or iPhone presentation.
Absolutely. And I think that to continue what Jim was saying, which is very important, which is the manufacturers of these, including PBS, who does very good work, don't really have any research proving the educational capacity of this. They basically, as with most apps, are throwing them out there in the market and seeing what happens. And so we have to be very careful that we're not just buying something because it says educational, and that makes us feel less guilty about using the shut-up toy. And I think that, you know, as altruistic as I'd like to be about parents going out and buying things to make their kids smarter or make their kids learn more, I think a lot of this is thinly veiled. How do I control my kid? How do I keep my kid quiet?
And then there's the whole question of what is it really doing to their, I don't know, their brain wiring, the way they interact with the world, if it's this instead of the sandbox. Michael Rich, please stand by here in the studio in Boston. Jim Steyer in Chicago. We're talking about kids and iPads, smartphones, touchscreens. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about very young children and high technology. What happens when toddlers take to iPads, iPhones, touchscreens, and apps as babysitters, as learning tools for a new, very young generation? Michael Rich is with us today. He's director of the Center on Media and Public Health at Children's Hospital, Boston, the mediatrician, father of four, knows something about kids, though they're a little older than the toddlers we're talking about, maybe. Jim Steyer joins us from Chicago, CEO and founder of Common Sense Media, author of Talking Back to Facebook. Jim, Michael, we've got lots of callers. Let's bring them and their experience right in here. Harrisonburg, Virginia, Kate is calling. Hi, Kate. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm a mother of two boys. They are 4 and almost 7.
Great.
And then I'm also a server at a restaurant, so I am coming at this from two different directions. I really understand the points of them as shut-up toys. I've seen them used numerous times like that. Also, as a mother, between the ages of my two boys, the iPad has really come around in those 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so my older son hasn't been exposed nearly as much as my younger son. I really use Common Sense Media. I have on and off been a natural parenting blogger for about 5 years. And so I understand that kids shouldn't have more than 2 hours of TV a day. And I think that if we are considering 2 hours, think if you're letting your child do 2 hours of iPad, iPod, smartphone, TV, video game. Let's say we're just adding all of those up to be 2 hours. When are we getting outside time? I try to really balance it. My kids get about a half hour in the evenings on school nights, and then they get more on weekends.
And is it tough, Kate? When they get their hands on the screen, do they want to stay on the screen, or do they want to run out and play?
We set boundaries. We'll say, like just yesterday, I have to admit, I went out to lunch with my sister, and she has an iPad, and my son knows that when his Auntie Gracie comes to visit, he gets to use her iPad. He also has to behave, and he also has to, listen as far as that's concerned. We used it as a shut-up toy in the restaurant. I struggle with it as a parent myself. But we also do set limits. You get to do this for this amount of time, and then it's all done and no arguments. And they know that if they do argue, then they don't get it the next time they ask.
Right, a shut-up toy in restaurants. Kate, we get it. When you're done serving in that restaurant, you come home. There, too, it may be helpful sometimes just to kind of give you a little peace and quiet. It's funny. I mean, people responding online. Rachel writes on Facebook, iPads for learning are great. More often I've seen them for pacifying questionable upper-class parenting. I think so, Rachel writes. Jennifer, Gloucester, Massachusetts. Jennifer, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. My husband and I have a 21-month-old girl, and we decided around the time she was born that we were going to try to keep her away from the high-tech toys for as long as we possibly could, not only because they're expensive, but because we're trying to teach her how to interact with people and with animals and with the world around her, trying to teach her how to process her feelings and to, you know, sort of interpret each situation appropriately. So, mm-hmm. I mean, whether she's in a restaurant or waiting in the car, you know, we try to hand her a book, hand her some crayons, or even take her out of the room if she's, you know, starting to act up a little bit. I've never heard the shut up toy term before today, but I think that that's a good term and also sort of a...
But Jennifer, do you worry, do you and your husband ever worry that your daughter may, like, fall behind? You're going to have these other kids who are all revved up on high tech and, you know, learning lickety-split or interacting lickety-split, and that she'll be, you know, sort of like coming along Amish style behind them.
No, I don't think so. I mean, it doesn't take long for an adult to learn how to use a smartphone, and I don't think it would take her very long when she finally gets one. You know, we're more concerned with her just sort of, you know, growing up, being able to interact with the world around her without feeling like she needs an electronic toy for a crutch. I've seen her use them every now and then. We have friends who come over and, you know, bring those, and it's just sort of disturbing to watch the glazed look that comes over her face when she, you know, plays with the iPad. I don't like it.
Yeah. Jennifer, I appreciate your call. Boy, there's a lot on the table here. Jim, first to you on the shut-up toy use for these. I mean, they are mesmerizing. It does work that way. Whatever's going on in the child's mind, it has that utility for a lot of people, I think, Jim.
No question. They're a pacifier. That's why I use the term shut-up toy. That's an old mm-hmm. toy industry term for, you know, how do you pacify kids, basically, and keep them quiet. And as a father of four, we've all done it. I certainly have, and we all know it. But it's really true. I think the big thing is you have to set limits. You know, I think your callers are suggesting something, Tom, that's so important for everybody to remember, which is you simply have to set limits. And there have to be rules. You know, in the Steyer family, you are not allowed to have an iPad or a phone at the dinner table or at mealtime ever. So we don't let our kids do that in a restaurant. And I don't think that, and on my recommendation in the book that I just wrote, Talking Back to Facebook, is that you should make meals, you know, device-free zones, whether you're at home or in a restaurant or wherever. Yes, they can pacify kids, but I think conversation is so important, as is playing outside, as all the other things that Michael was mentioning earlier in his comments. So I think it's obviously we all need and we use media and devices at times to pacify our kids, and that can be okay in moderation. But it's a big trend, and I think parents really need to be aware of setting limits and setting these device-free zones for their kids.
Michael Rich, take us into some of the nuance here. I mean, part of what I think people are focused on here is just how young kids are when they jump on these things and how they take to them so naturally. And we know that at those very young ages, some fundamental patterns of interaction with the world are taking place. So Jennifer says, you know, she's worried about her daughter interacting with people and animals and the material world, not just the digital. Does it set up a sort of pace of interaction or a certain kind of, you know, impactless interaction? Because after all, the touchscreen never bites back, right? I mean, does it sort of mess around with how kids understand the world?
Well, I think you bring up a really important point, and I applaud Jennifer's approach because what we have to recognize is particularly during the first 2 years of life, when the brain is tripling in volume and is moving from several thousand synaptic connections to tens and hundreds of thousands of synaptic connections as we build our mature brain, it is doing that in response to the challenges and stimuli it's receiving from the environment mm-hmm. around it. And so if you want the child to function entirely in a touchscreen world, then touchscreens may be great. The problem is that they do a lot for you, and they don't present a lot of resistance to and questions and problems to solve. And so I think that one of the things we have to realize is that just pacifying the child has its outcomes that we're not thinking about, that time spent with that device instead of talking to mom or learning to stay quiet or learning to wait your turn at the restaurant or deferring gratification for your food to come mm-hmm. are all important skills that they're going to need later in life. If they're not presented with them not just once, not just twice, but over and over and over again, they will not learn them. That's one piece of
this. So what's the risk factor of a child who's spending too many hours in the touchscreen realm?
Is that they won't have the experience to learn from the real world. They won't learn how to interact with real human beings as opposed to with Martha Speaks on the touchpad.
And the consequences of that, is this the path to, I don't know, attention deficit or just a different kind of personality or maybe one that's better wired to engage in a world that's so digital now?
Perhaps, but we have to go in with our eyes open. We have to go in knowing what we do know, knowing what we need to learn about how we interact with and are changed by not just these devices, but the content on those devices and on the balance, the diversity of experience our children have as they grow.
So we're doing a kind of experiment on this young generation.
We're doing a vast uncontrolled experiment here, right? And part of the reason for existence of the Center on Media and Child Health is to bring evidence to bear on this because historically, even with television, we have mostly said opinion and values-based opinion at that as our recommendations for what people should do. And we need to bring the same level of rigorous science to how we are changed by these media and how we use these media as we do to, say, nutrition or traffic safety.
How long until we know if the profile of a iPad-raised toddler's brain is different synaptically than somebody in a sandbox and with a coloring book?
It depends on the question you ask. It may be a generation. Or it may be a week, depending on what function you are looking at the development of. So in other words, if you're looking at learning something, you can measure it short term. You mm-hmm. can measure it for retention at a week later. You can measure it for retention 10 years later. Mm-hmm. And so many of these things are ongoing empirical research that's going on, observational research that's going on, but that, you know, the question really drives the outcome and the answer to your question, which is, are you worried about what the adult brain will look like? Well, you have to wait until that child becomes an adult.
Wow.
And frankly, in that much time, mm-hmm. iPads are going to be gone and we'll be
It'll be something entirely different. But the imprint will remain. Jim Steyer, so if it's guesses in large part now, but you work with this material a lot. I mean, what's your intuition tell you about upside and downside of early engagement with the whole touchscreen, smartphone, iPad world?
You know, Tom, that's the great thing about not being a doctor like Michael. I can actually just make my – I can just say what I think because I'm just a parent and an educator. You know, I think that there – I think the upsides are that certainly there's new ways to learn, and particularly if they're well-designed apps, and that's why we built this educational rating system that hopefully will become very popular and useful for parents and all consumers. You know, that there's going to be ways that you can enhance learning, and I think we will see some of that. You know, for me, I think I actually say, first of all, particularly for young kids, just that too much time in front of the screen is really a problem. And I think that, you know, my intuition is that in limited quantities, it's fine. And if you're in a smart, healthy balance with clear limits and clear boundaries, it's going to be fine. Too much of it, though, I think there's real downsides. I think it does affect brain development. I'm no pediatrician or brain scientist like Michael is, but, you know, I definitely think that it's affecting kids' brains. It's affecting the way they learn. It's affecting their short-term memory. That was what Michael was talking about. We see this in older kids.
For better or worse, short-term memory?
Yeah, I think for worse. You know, there was a big study by some of my colleagues at Stanford about how multitasking is a myth and, in fact, how you can't do multiple tasks at one time on these devices and actually retain stuff. So I think Michael's right, and you're right, Tom. We are conducting this vast, uncontrolled experiment on our kids with virtually no research funding. You know, Common Sense took over the Kaiser Family Foundation research program, which is what led to our 0-8 study last fall. And Michael does great research in his work there at Harvard and in Boston. And, you know, there's just so little funding for this. It's insane because this is our kids' development. This is some of the most fundamental child development, educational kinds of stuff that all of our children are going to go through. And right now, we are conducting it with very little research behind it and with mass marketing campaigns, which, you know, are going to get much bigger in the coming years. This is the number one area of growth on the on the Apple iTunes store. And what we're going to start to see is more and more of this. There's a gap, by the way. The other thing that one of your emailers mentioned is the fact that upper-income parents are far more likely to use educational content and download apps than our lower-income parents. We found that in our research last fall. So these are very important questions that we should be researching. And I, not being a doctor, unlike Michael, I'm willing to say, hey, there's a lot of downside if you plunk your kid in front of a screen for too long, whether it's an iPad, and even if it has educational content, you really got to set limits.
Well, you can, I mean, you can imagine the downside. On the other hand, you may well have parents thinking, well, if I don't get my kids in the game here pretty soon, they're going to be up against some, I don't know, turbocharged hyper learners who, hey, Emily in Nashville, Tennessee. Emily, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me. I wanted to just say quickly thank you to the Common Sense Media. Their work has really helped shape my work. I'm a doctoral student and have just finished collecting data on a study in a preschool using iPads with four-year-olds.
So good. Data. Tell us. What did you learn?
I'm not working with the little ones, but four-year-olds. And what I did was I offered children opportunities to use open-ended composing apps where they could type and they could color and they could draw and they could use stamps and photos of themselves. And then they would email them back to their parents. And then their parents could respond. So we were, it was kind of like modern-day technology-based message-making, letter-writing, if
okay,
you will. And I think that one of the important things that we're kind of talking about, but this is an example of, is the level of interactivity that children are having when they're using the screen. So instead of simply handing the screen to the child and it being more of a passive experience, giving children a specific purpose and adults or other children to interact with during their engagement. So in this activity, I was there with the child supporting them as they tried to spell words or asking them what their message was as they were composing. And then they also would get replies back from their parents. We worked so much on various literacy skills, message making, letter sound matches, and all of these things are important literacy skills, but we were able to use the ease of technology and parents were able to respond quickly. They responded in ways that they don't typically respond when a child writes a note and puts it in their cubby and the parent picks them up and might look at the letter but rarely will ever write them back.
Are you talking about a parent who's there with the child or off at work somewhere and just texting?
The parent is off at work or the parent is off at work and then can send an email back.
Boy, I mean,
an email with
but of course that I will talk about that. But you also know, as several have said here, you know, a lot of times this is a you know, here, take this and get out of my hair thing, like not an apparent engagement tool, but very often, Emily, the opposite, right?
Right. So what I'm saying is that I think we really need to encourage parents to think about beyond setting limits and beyond but to think about what it is that they're offering their child on the screen. So if they're offering more interactive activities where they could, for example, take pictures and make their own set of ABC flashcards.
Yeah, no, we got it. Sort of be actively engaged with it and the child. I mean, it's interesting. People responding in all kinds of ways. You know, Mandrake says, my child's getting a cortical Wi-Fi implant, says online. Tanya says, confession time. I have totally used technology as a babysitter for my four-year-old. However, I'm not under the impression that he's learning anything as he plays PBS Kids on the computer or Angry Birds on the smartphone. Mark Rich, what about Emily in her research? She's looking at maybe mom or dad is off at work and they're responding to the child who's on a smartphone or iPad. Okay, there's that. It's a disembodied parent, but it's a parent. Maybe better than none. On the other hand, it's not exactly, you know, having the child up in your arms and reading and getting all the sort of senses that go along with that.
I think Emily's work and your question bring up a really important point, which is that with each of these, we have to think about what we're offering them, but we also have to think about what we are offering it instead of. In other words, to look at what it may displace in either the child's experience or the parent's experience. So I think that one of the things that we have to learn from all of this is, what do these devices do well? What do they do not as well? Let's not delude ourselves into thinking because they're easy, they're doing something well. And let's use them for what they do well and put them away and do other things when other things like putting your child in your lap and reading and talking to them is better.
But they're cascading into people's lives right now, into very young people's lives as well. Michael Rich with Children's Hospital Boston, please stand by. And Jim Steyer in Chicago with Common Sense Media. We're talking about children and iPads, toddlers and iPads. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The music, you may know it from Angry Birds behind us there. Pretty simple game. Educational tool, maybe not, but very, very young children are playing it. iPads, smartphones, touch screens, all over the toddler world these days. We're talking about that this hour with Michael Rich. He's director of the Center on Media and Child Health at Children's Hospital Boston. Also has the AskTheMediatrician.org blog you can check in on and put questions to. Jim Steyer is with us, CEO and founder of Common Sense Media. It's a nonprofit that studies the effects of media on children. He's also author of Talking Back to Facebook. He joins us today from Chicago. Let's go right to Susan in Somerset, Kentucky. Susan, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to tell you that I think that it's a wonderful, fantastic opportunity that we're offering our kids. What we need to do is keep up with them and learn what it is they're doing so that we can guide them. I think we're kidding ourselves if we think that we're going to give them something or offer it to them. The minute that child goes to daycare, to a place, someplace with other children, they are going to get these things whether we want them to have them or not. In my case, they're going to get them from grandma, because I had an instance when I was stuck in a wheelchair last summer, so I bought one of these Kindle Flames, and I was trying to catch up with the old Downton Abbey
series
that I hadn't seen. And in the course of doing that, I started following links. I read three books about that era. I got on the internet and learned all about workhouses and how you can trace your genealogy if your parents or your ancestors happened to be had come from a workhouse, that kind of thing.
So grandma, you got stuck in a wheelchair, you got into your Kindle, and what, you came out of it a believer? You're going to shower these on your grandchildren?
In that period, I did the same thing with the tutors, and then I don't have an iPad. I have an iPhone.
Okay.
And I understood they had these interactive books that that they also have in textbooks. So I thought, well, I went to camp with for dog training, and I was at a dead spot. So I downloaded one of those, downloaded a somewhat related movie, and read a book that had all kinds of links that went to the movies. And I mean, you know, it was really fantastic.
Do you worry? I mean, Susan, you've got the experience of being a mother and a grandmother. Do you worry that kids will end up, I don't know, skittery and jittery with all that kind of stuff hopping around on the apps?
No, I don't. I think it could happen, but I think our job, again, is to catch up with them and understand what they're doing. When I was a little girl, or rather a teenager, there was a book I wanted to read that my dad didn't approve of. He tore that thing up three times before. I had to buy the book four times before I got it read. I promised myself I'd never do that to my children, so I let them read anything they wanted to. I didn't censor it at all. What I did is read what they were reading.
And now you can have anything you want on that Kindle, and who's to know? Susan, I appreciate your call. Thank you very much. And let me get one more. Beth in Sudbury, Massachusetts. Beth, you're on.
Oh, hi, Tom. I am a psychotherapist, and what I've seen in the last 5 to 10 years is an increasing amount of anxiety in 9 to 10-year-old children, 9 to 12-year-olds specifically. And a lot of it is related to the inability of parents nowadays to say no, to set boundaries for children who desperately need them. I work across the board in every socioeconomic realm.
Yeah.
And not only do I have parents in the waiting room who are doing on their own iPhone and have given an iPad to their toddler, 3-year-old, 5-year-old, 10-year-old, so there's no communication there. And then I get kids, pre-adolescents, adolescents, telling me of these extreme anxieties. And when I speak with parents, 9 times out of 10, there's very little discipline. Now, that's across the board. What is replacing discipline and saying no is here, just do this instead, and replacing no, you have to sit still in church, in a restaurant, with here, do this. So children are learning, they're not learning how to be patient, they're not learning how to be bored. And all of those things help, I believe, us, those who are older, to become competent, to figure things out, to use our brains in a way that we problem solve instead of the problems being solved for you. And I think it's related directly to the amount of anxiety I'm seeing in children.
Well, let me pick up a couple of threads there, Beth, and I appreciate your call. The first one, Jim, I'll bring to you. I mean, there's this issue of modeling, because you've got kids, you know, I don't know, if 10 years ago they might have seen mom and dad reading now or watching TV, now they may see them on their device all the time. It's kind of a weird thing that if you try to make kids grow up in Little House on the Prairie with a book, well, mom and dad always have their nose in a screen themselves, we hear our caller describing.
That's a great point, Tom. You're absolutely right. I mean, you know, in the book that I just wrote, and talking back to Facebook, I wrote about exactly what Beth, our caller, just said, how this is incredibly important, how this is actually changing the nature of relationships between kids and adults, between young people and their parents, and between young people and their friends. Enormous implications for human communication and also social-emotional development, quite frankly, and identity. And you're absolutely right, Tom, that the role modeling by parents is critical. If you're constantly tethered to your Crackberry, or you're going to meals with your kids and spending half the time looking at your phone or your iPad and not paying attention to them, it has enormous consequences on the social emotional front, and people do not pay as much attention. You know, attention can be, in the more medical terms that Michael knows, you know, attention deficit disorders, and you can talk about how digital media can contribute to ADHD. But it's also attention in the context of how we pay attention to other people and what that means in terms of empathy and intimacy and human relationships. These are enormous issues. And as kids get older, as Beth, the caller, was just saying, has some huge implications, and it goes from the iPad to Facebook and other platforms where kids can become immersed in them and, in a sense, lose the normal kind of human relationships or certainly traditional kind of human relationships to more digitally enhanced ones. These are really important issues for us to be talking about as a society, at homes, in schools, and on great programs like yours, Tom, because this is a fundamental change in the nature of human interaction and communication, with upsides, but with significant downsides, and the conversation is just beginning.
So maybe this is what they'll be listening to. This is an app, The Monster at the End of the Book, based on the Sesame Street book of the same name. It's an interactive read-along.
Shh! Listen. I have an idea. If you do not turn any pages, we will never get to the end of this book. And that is good, because there is a monster at the end of this book. So please do not turn the page.
Michael Rich, so many questions. One is just this. If a child comes up from an early age associating this experience, the kind of thing we just saw, and of course there's lots of visuals with it as well, and Fisher-Price now makes these jazzy, tumbling, colorful, shiny, even frames to go around your touchscreen, will they ever be able to go back to a book? Will a book just look like a dead, dull thing? And does that matter, Michael?
Quite possibly they won't be able to go back to a book. You kind of wonder about that child who's reading The Monster at the End of the Book when he's asked to read Moby Dick in ninth or tenth grade.
Just black text on a white gray page.
Exactly. And
no whales jumping out of the text.
Exactly. Will he be able to follow through to develop his own images rather than wait for the images to be provided to them? And I think that we have to look at the role of resistance to information as the learning process, too. In other words, we have to provide space for our children to use their imaginations. And the way we do that is not by providing them the image of that monster or that whale jumping out, but saying, imagine if you will. And
I mean, I don't want to over-glamorize the past just because it was the past.
Not
but
at
I
all.
Recall from youth and somewhere in this age, reading very early, but when play became boring, and, you know, the toy box only had so many toys, a book didn't look dull. It was just text on paper. But I knew when I picked up the book, my imagination would explode. And suddenly all that would be going on. It wasn't handed to me, but it was more exciting than the colorful, shiny stuff very often, Michael, rather than less.
Absolutely. And we actually have brain research now looking with functional magnetic resonance imaging at human brains that when they are wandering, their minds are wandering, that a much larger and more complex and diverse network of the brain lights up than when they are doing any activity, whether it's watching television or reading a book or tapping your fingers together. And that's because, you know, when the mind is given space, the mind does unique things to that individual and goes in places it wouldn't necessarily go. In fact, late in his life, when Einstein was asked, how come you came up with this incredibly complex, well thought through and airtight theory when you were back in your, you know, youth?
Special relativity.
And he said, because I was bored.
What about, I mean, we've missed that. You gain an iPad and you miss Einstein. What about, Jim says, you know, there may be a connection between digital media and ADHD. Is that, are we in the realm of knowing that clinically yet? Is it just speculation?
It is speculation based on both observation and some theoretical components, which is that as you're building a brain, if you are in a situation where it is instantly gratified by any need, it won't develop the circuitry necessary to stick with a task and follow it through to the end. So this again goes back to the difference between, say, interactive books and books that you have to build that world, build that story, build those characters.
Mm-hmm.
And think about the number of times you went to see the movie of a book and you said, no, that's not the way he looks. That's not what that world is like. And we realize that these are very personal experiences and they're very different experiences when they're experienced in a movie or a book or an interactive iPad.
Let's go to Ann calling from Boston. Ann, thanks. You're on the air.
Oh, hi, Tom.
Hi.
This is a fascinating conversation.
Good.
I work as a speech pathologist with preschoolers and mm-hmm. I'm a consultant to schools and I'm in the middle of writing a blog for Harvard Health Publications mm-hmm. on this exact subject. This has been a great conversation. I think there's a middle ground here. I think that some of the iPad apps are wonderful and helpful, and even Grover can be helpful if you sit down with the child and you interact with him as you go through each page so you don't lose that relationship. I don't think there's anything to substitute for the relationship between the teacher or the parent and the child, and I think that's the first key. And I think the other thing you're talking about is to limit the child's time, especially if you're just giving it to him as a babysitter. I don't think that's a good idea. I think there's some questions you should ask yourself, like sit down with an app first before you let your child use it and find out is it loud or violent or are figures moving too fast and darting across the screen and are the characters killing everything in sight? And is there a narrative for the child? Like, for example, one of the better apps I like is Jib Jab Junior. They have storybooks, and you take a picture of the child and put him in the storybook.
Mm-hmm.
And they laugh, and you can have conversations about each page, about the biggest pizza ever.
And you're describing, in a way, best practices. But,
right.
I mean, you know, how many violent, quick, flashing things are out there already? I mean, what are the odds? And how parents need a break and are looking for a way to get one? I mean, how much of the time that kids are on the touchscreen do you think is going to be done in that sort of perfect way?
Well, you know, it isn't hard. It's not rocket science. I think parents can do it and teachers can do it. I think if you just hand a child Angry Birds, first of all, it's loud, crashing cages and the birds are set free, but it's very violent if you just don't look at the pictures. You
mm-hmm.
see, you hear these crashing noises like buildings being blown up.
Yeah.
You know, for a little toddler, it's not good for their sensory issues. It's not good for their brain, and it's just an app I would limit.
Anne, I appreciate your call very much, and stick with that research. We need plenty on this. Jim, what's your sense of actual use, reality here, how parents are actually using these things with toddlers, and what portion of the society is using them? I mean, smartphones, there's a lot of those out there. iPads, as many as there are, it's a tiny fraction of families that are going to be tossing them around to toddlers.
Well, I think, Anne, first of all, Anne made a lot of really good points, and I think the balanced approach that she was enunciating is actually a very intelligent way to go about this, and I think that's what we recommend at Common Sense. We rate all these things. That's why we try to make it easy for a parent so they can figure out which are the appropriate ones for their kids and not. I think you got to assume that the genie's out of the bottle, and that basically all kids are going to have access to this. Right now, I mentioned earlier what we call the app gap, which is that upper-income families and middle- and upper-income families are far more likely to download educational apps right now than our lower-income families. That may change. So I think that I think the use will be ubiquitous, and I think it's a global phenomenon, not just here in the United States. So I think we should assume the ubiquity of these platforms. I think we have to teach norms of behavior right away and set clear rules of the road for parents, educators, and young people about time limits, proper use, that kind of stuff. I think we have an educational process that we really need to go through as a society for the next couple of years and really talk with parents and teachers about this. One of the points that Anne made, I think that was a very smart one, is that it's so much better if you as a parent or as a teacher sit down and use an app with the child as opposed to just handing them the iPad or some other tablet or phone and just using it as a shut-up toy. And the involvement, that engagement is so critical. It's like reading to your child or having them sit on your lap and playing games with them. That interaction is so key. And Michael Rich is absolutely right about the imagination issue as well and the importance of children having their own creativity and using their brains in that kind of creative way. So this is such a new phenomenon. It's actually has so many exciting possibilities if used well and if used with clear boundaries and limits. So it's a whole new world out there now, and we have to use common sense, if you will. And Tom, people need to really accept that this is not going to go away, but then think about, as a parent or as an educator, how can we make this the best possible experience?
Yeah, that sounds great. I'm sure everybody wants to do it. But, I mean, common sense, what does that really mean? You know, Michael, Jim says the genie's out of the bottle. He's probably right. On the other hand, you know, is this really destiny? You know, Romans made stemware out of lead. That was out of the bottle. That didn't turn out so well. You know, are we going to come back in a generation and see, I don't know, will we be like dull-witted compared to those down the road? They'll be chattering on and, you know, sort of iPad speed and look back on adults of our age as sort of leaden, heavy, slow. They'll be moving.
Well, I think that that's not new to this generation. That's happened to every generation. The rock and rollers didn't think their parents were moving very fast either. So I think that's a natural human evolution issue. I think the bigger issue we have here is that we have to keep our eyes open. We have to base this not on opinion and on hearsay, but on evidence, on good science, and on good observation, and make informed decisions and use these tools mindfully.
Watch this space. It is an exploding avenue of interaction for kids, and consequences we still don't entirely know. Michael Rich of the Center on Media and Child Health at Children's Hospital Boston, askthemediatrician.org. Thanks so much for being with us, Michael.
Thank you.
And Jim Steyer in Chicago, CEO of Common Sense Media, author of Talking Back to Facebook. Jim, thank you very much for your insights this hour.
Thank you for having us, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.